I look at this trip as a photo op that I put on the same level as landing on the aircraft carrier. That basically this is preparation for November 2004, and it's attempting to remind or make African Americans believe that November 2000 in Florida really wasn't all that bad.
The issue of nuclear weapons and the presence of Al-Qaeda and the lack of democracy in Iran.
And so I witnessed somewhere between 800 and 900 murders of civilians, mostly young women and children, and that turned me against the war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch from Monday, July 7th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A parliamentary committee has exonerated the British government from what it called the sexing up of a crucial intelligence data used by Tony Blair to make the case for invading Iraq. According to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the sharply divided Common Foreign Affairs Select Committee cleared Blair's communications chief of misleading the country over the threat posed by Saddam Hussein in the run-up to the war by a one-vote margin. But the committee has said Prime Minister Blair published an unreliable intelligence dossier and that he inadvertently misled Parliament. It had also found the controversial claim that Iraq could deploy chemical and biological weapons within 45 minutes was given undue prominence. In 2 days of attacks in Baghdad, 3 U.S. soldiers have been killed, raising the total of American combat deaths since President Bush declared the major hostilities over May 1st to anywhere between 60, according to the New York Times, and 30, according to the Associated Press. The military says a roadside bomb killed one soldier traveling in an army convoy today, and a second American was shot to death in a Sunday night gun battle at the troubled Sunni Muslim neighborhood of Azamiyah. Both soldiers belonged to the Army's 1st Armored Division, the Germany-based unit occupying Baghdad. Also Sunday, a U.S. soldier was shot and killed drinking a soda in the shade at Baghdad University. Families of troops stationed in Iraq are growing increasingly frustrated that their husbands, wives, sons, and daughters have not come home yet, even though Bush declared 2 months ago that the major combat operations in Iraq have ended. An article in the New York Times over the weekend reports frustrations became so bad recently at Fort Stewart, Georgia, that a colonel meeting with 800 seething spouses, most of them wives, had to be escorted from the session. They were, quote, crying, cussing, yelling, and screaming for their men to come back, said Lucia Braxton, director of community services at Fort Stewart. Julie Van Teslar is the wife of Specialist Kelly Van Teslar, who was stationed in northern Iraq. He returned home a few weeks ago when Julie was diagnosed with congenital heart failure after giving birth to their third child, a baby girl named Samantha. Peace Watch spoke with Julie today about her experience as an expectant mom and as a soldier's wife.
They weren't able to send him home for the birth. I mean, he was able to call 10 minutes before I went into heavy labor with Samantha, and I told him when he got home that she was just waiting for him to say it was okay for her to start coming into this world. And, you know, that was probably the hardest thing, was that he wasn't here. I think the second hardest was to see the conditions over there of the people and everything. I know he said that they had stopped at a store to buy some sodas, and there was a 12-year-old boy, and he was talking to my husband, trying to sell him things. My husband felt so bad because he didn't have any extra cash on him to buy anything, you know, even a soda from him. And that was what that he said, you know, that's how that little boy lived, was being able to sell stuff, and he couldn't buy anything from him. So he felt really bad that he wasn't able to buy anything from him. But, you know, he's just a little 12-year-old kid, and he has to think that's only 2 years older than our oldest.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't imagine our son being in that position and having to go through life the way they do over there.
Hmm. Of course, your husband was one of the lucky ones. Over 60 Americans have been killed in this conflict since May 1st, when the president actually declared the major hostilities were over. And so he's one of the lucky ones that was able to return to his family. In fact, many of the wives and mothers of some of Men still stationed in Iraq have gotten increasingly frustrated. There's an article in the New York Times that said at a meeting at Fort Stewart, Georgia, a group of 800 or so were so frustrated that the colonel who was briefing them had to be escorted from the session with security. Can you in any way identify with those emotions?
Well, I knew that there was, 800 or I think 900 soldiers that came home to Fort Stewart. We're at Fort Benning, which is another part, a big part of 3rd ID, which led the charge into Iraq. We've had soldiers that have been gone since last year, September. And, I have neighbors all around me who are frustrated beyond belief because their husbands or wives or boyfriends, girlfriends have not come home yet. And I can identify with that, really. I can understand the frustration, but on the other hand, we all know that our husbands and wives have a job to do over there. We were all well aware of what they did before we married them. And that's hard on me to hear somebody tell me that. Believe it or not, it really is, because we don't want to, it's to the point we don't want to hear it. But the truth of it is we knew what our husbands did before we married them. We knew that there is always a possibility that they would have to go to war. And there's always the possibility that they might not come home in a 6-month tour. It might be a year. My heart goes out to every family who has lost a family member in Iraq. And I pray daily that this ends soon and that the soldiers are able to start coming home.
Julie Van Teslar, wife of Specialist Kelly Van Teslar, who was stationed recently in northern Iraq. He was returned home when Julie was diagnosed with congenital heart failure. Well, every soldier's story is unique in some way. In February, Peace Watch broadcast an interview with a U.S. Marine who was opposed to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. At the time, he asked that we not use his name and that we disguise his voice to ensure that none of the members of his platoon think he was not prepared to serve to the best of his ability. This soldier died in Iraq at the end of June. Peace Watch has decided to rebroadcast segments of that interview today in wake of recent events. We're still not disclosing the soldier's identity, but this time to honor the wishes of his family. Peace Watch correspondent Ingrid Drake files this report.
He earned a master's degree and studied foreign affairs with an emphasis on the Middle East, philosophy, military history, and peace studies. A day before his deployment with the U.S. Marines, he agreed to speak with me about his concerns about a U.S.-led invasion of Iraq.
And this millennia, the purpose of war is to create a better peace. It's a last resort measure. It is almost unimaginable to expect that this war is going to create a better peace for anybody, with the exception of a very small percentage of people. But even then, because there are so many factors that could go wrong, that could not work out. I mean, everything is based upon a very rosy scenario, upon the Iraqis surrendering, upon them being able to get Saddam Hussein, upon the Iraqis not being able lashing out members of the Ba'ath Party, upon being able to get other members of the United Nations to pay for reconstruction. Also, that's going to quell terrorism. It's going to do all these things. There are so many balls to keep in the air with this. It's such a remote, slim possibility. And the administration doesn't seem to acknowledge any of these questions. They don't seem to address these questions. And they don't seem to be talking honestly with the American people about the nature of urban combat, the nature of aerial bombardment, about Iraqi psychology, about the Middle East, about terrorism, about anything. And even if we come out scot clean, victorious, and there's no American casualties and everything goes the way it's supposed to go, what does that mean for the world order? I mean, that's an inclusive question that I don't know if I have the answers to that one, but it sets up that we basically can do whatever we want to do whenever we want to do it because we're the world's sole superpower.
During the interview, he outlined various options the U.S. could take to nurture democracy in Iraq, including investing $200 billion into grassroots democracy projects as opposed to military arms. While the soldier had many ideas on alternatives to a U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, he recognized his knowledge base would not be tapped into by the armed forces.
As soon as I show up in uniform, there is no question in my mind. I have a duty which comes first. It has to come first. That's part of what being a Marine is. And there's no more reading the newspaper. There's no more studying. There's no more studying political science or history. Ideally, I'd like to be helping the armed services in a position where they would use my background, but that's not my job.
He could enthusiastically quote from the American Constitution and United Nations charters on international law. It was partly his respect for the concepts of freedom, democracy, and peace that led him to join the armed forces. But it was also a pragmatic decision. According to his close friend, he chose to go into the Marines as a way to earn credibility as a foreign affairs analyst.
He joined the reserves under the Clinton administration, and he joined basically to gain credibility so that people would listen to him, so that people would hear what he had to say about creating peace in the Middle East, because before then he was just a guy, you know, a kid with a master's degree, and who's going to listen to him? And people weren't listening to him. He was trying to get jobs and nobody would take him seriously. He just had so many different sides to him, and he was comfortable with them all. He knew himself so well, and he was a philosopher. He was a classical guitarist. He read poetry. He was a Marine. He was a bartender. He was just the best friend anybody could ever have. He was so loyal. He was always there. Any time you needed him, he would rearrange his whole schedule to be there for a friend. And he was really, really deep, and he was tortured by what's going on in the world.
When the U.S. Congress was debating whether to grant war powers to President Bush, the soldier started volunteering a lot of his time at a local peace organization. It was there he met Jen. Jen describes what she remembers most about him.
I think the thing to me that stands out as most memorable was just his really strong knowledge of the Middle East. I was actually learning from the conversations we would have about the Middle East.
Through their discussions, Jen and the soldier developed a friendship. When he was deployed, he wrote several letters to Jen describing his experience and his analysis of the situation. Jen reads excerpts from a letter he wrote in Iraq on April 19th.
I have had little news of home since after the start of the war. I did hear about the protests during the opening days. Believe it or not, I was thrilled. I hope they went on, never giving the administration a moment's rest. I pray they had and have some effect, if not on today, then for the future. We can't let this happen again. I need to go now, but I just wanted to write at least once more from Iraq. If the administration makes good on its promise, I'll be home by July 4th, though likely sooner. Right now, I haven't a clue what to do with myself when I get home. Years were spent, hours, days with Iraq and this war occupying my time. It's over now, so some soul searching will be in order. Regardless, my commitment to peace remains. If anything, yes, it's stronger.
This past weekend, his family and friends gathered for his funeral. Jen attended the funeral and got an opportunity to learn that his peace work did not stop when he was in Iraq.
His father read a letter to us from one of his commanding officers that talked about a situation. He had studied Arabic for 2 years, and he had some grasp of the language. There was a situation where there were Ba'ath Party officials in a house, and the Marines typically might have just stormed the house. With his use of the Arabic language and the fact that he was committed to diplomacy and peace, he went in and actually talked with the officials in the house and navigated a surrender situation. And according to people who were with him during the war in Iraq, there were other situations where both American soldiers and civilian lives were saved because of his desire for peace and diplomacy.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C. Many thanks to Chris Strom of D.C. Indy Media for help on this piece.
This soldier died in Iraq at the end of June. In the latest colloquial quip to put the president in hot water, Bush delivered a taunt of sorts late last week to Iraqi militants who have been attacking U.S. troops on a daily basis. He said, quote, "bring them on," unquote, and asserted that the U.S. forces in Iraq are, quote, "plenty tough," unquote, to deal with the ongoing threat. Bush's statement provoked harsh criticism from some congressional Democrats and members of the military who cited his lack of personal military experience and what they perceive as insensitivity to the plight of soldiers in the field. Among those critical of the president is former Special Forces soldier Stan Goff.
In 1970, when I arrived at my unit, Company A, 4th Battalion, 503rd Infantry, 173rd Airborne Brigade, in what was then the Republic of Vietnam, I was charged up for a fight. I believe that if we didn't stop the communists in Vietnam, we'd eventually be fighting this global conspiracy in the streets of Hot Springs, Arkansas. I'd been toughened by basic training, infantry training, and parachute training, taught how to use my weapons and equipment, and I was confident in my ability to vanquish the skinny Untermenschen. So I was dismayed when one of my new colleagues, a veteran who'd been there 10 months, told me, "We are losing this war." Not only that, he said if I wanted to survive for my 1 year there, I had to understand one very basic thing. All Vietnamese were the enemy, and for us, the grunts on the ground, this was a race war. Within 1 month, it was apparent that everything he told me was true, and that every reason that was being given to the American public for the war was not true. We had a battalion commander whom I never saw. He would fly over in a Loach helicopter and give cavalier instructions to do things like take your unit 13 kilometers to the north. In the Central Highlands, 13 kilometers is something we had to hack out with machetes in 98-degree heat, carrying sometimes 90 pounds over our body weights over steep, slippery terrain. The battalion commander never picked up a machete as far as we knew, and after these directives, he'd fly back to an air-conditioned headquarters in LZ English near Bong Son. We often fantasized together about shooting his helicopter down as a way of relieving our deep resentment against this faceless, starched, and spit-shined despot. Recently, when I read that U.S. Commander-in-Chief George W. Bush, in the moment of blustering armchair machismo, sent a message to the non-existent Iraqi guerrillas to bring them on, the first image in my mind was a 20-year-old soldier in an ever more fragile marriage who'd been away from home for 8 months. He participated in the initial invasion and was told he'd be home for the 4th of July. He has a newfound familiarity with corpses, and everything he thought he knew last year is now under revision. He is sent out into the streets of Fallujah or some other city, where he has already been shot at once or twice with automatic weapons or an RPG, and his nerves are raw. He is wearing Kevlar and ceramic body armor, a Kevlar helmet, a load-carrying harness with ammunition, grenades, flex cuffs, first aid gear, water, and assorted other paraphernalia. His weapon weighs 7 pounds, 10 with a double magazine. His boots are bloused, and his long-sleeved shirt is buttoned at the wrist. It's between 100 and 110 degrees Fahrenheit at midday. He's been eating MREs 3 times a day when he has an appetite in this heat, and even his urine is beginning to smell like preservatives. Mosquitoes and sandflies plague him in the evenings, and he probably pulls a guard shift every night, never sleeping straight through. He and his comrades are beginning to get on each other's nerves. The rumors of going home, not going home, are keeping him on an emotional roller coaster. Directives from on high are contradictory, confusing, and often stupid. The whole population seems hostile to him, and he's developing a deep animosity for Iraq and all its people, as well as for official narratives. This is the lad who will hear from someone that George W. Bush, dressed in a suit with a belly full of rich food, just hurled a manly taunt from a 72-degree studio at the non-existent Iraqi resistance. This de facto president is finally seeing his poll numbers fall. Even chauvinist paranoia has a half-life, it seems. His legitimacy is being eroded as even the mainstream press has discovered now that the pretext for the war was a lie. It may have been control over the oil after all. Anti-war forces are regrouping as an anti-occupation movement. Now, exercising his one true talent, blundering, George W. Bush has begun the improbable process of alienating the very troops upon whom he depends to carry out the neocon ambition of restructuring the world by arms. Somewhere in Balad or Fallujah or Baghdad, there is a soldier telling a new replacement, "We are losing this war."
Stan Goff is a former Special Forces soldier and the author of Hideous Dream, a soldier's memoir of the U.S. invasion of Haiti, and the upcoming book Full Spectrum Disorder. He retired in 1996 from the U.S. Army from 3rd Special Forces and now lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. His commentary appeared recently on the counterpunch.org website. Liberian President Charles Taylor said Sunday he would step down from power to end the civil war currently enveloping his country. Thousands have died in the 13-year conflict, and Taylor has been indicted for war crimes by a UN-backed court in Sierra Leone. The New York Times reports that Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo met Taylor at the airport in the Liberian capital of Monrovia to offer him asylum, which Taylor accepted. He urged the U.S. to send peacekeepers to ensure an orderly exit from Monrovia, which is surrounded by rebel forces, but he gave no time frame for when he would quit power and did not specify whether the deployment of U.S. troops was a condition for his departure. The U.S. has been under growing international pressure to send troops to participate in a peacekeeping force. West African nations have said they will provide 3,000 soldiers for the mission, but they've suggested that the United States send 2,000 more. Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate Armed Services Committee said yesterday that they want President Bush to get congressional approval before sending any U.S. troops to the region. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said military leaders would prefer that West African armies take the lead in any effort to end the brutal conflict. The issue has particular relevance because Liberia was founded as a colony for freed American slaves in the 1800s. Bush leaves today for a five-nation tour in Africa. While he's not stopping in Liberia, he will visit Senegal, South Africa, Botswana, Uganda, and Nigeria. The question of whether the U.S. should intervene to quell the violence in Liberia is sure to be a hotly contested topic. Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, spoke this morning with Bill Fletcher, president of TransAfrica, and Mel Foote, president and CEO of Constituency for Africa, a coalition of organizations and groups that educates Americans about Africa and African issues. She started off with the discussion by asking Bill Fletcher whether he thinks U.S. troops should be deployed to Liberia.
I am not in favor of U.S. troops being there. I think that the situation in Liberia needs to ultimately be handled by Africans, specifically West Africans. But I do think that the United States should provide the financial and logistical support to make this happen. I think when you look at U.S. interventions, particularly since World War II, you find a series of missteps, of imperial adventures, of often arrogant approaches towards those interventions. And when you add to that the notion that the U.S. troops would only be there under U.S. command, it's not like they would be there under U.N. command, I think that there's all the seeds there for problems. Fundamentally, in the building of an African solution, which is what we have to really look at, an African solution, and looking at the Liberian crisis as part of a West African crisis. It's not something that's in isolation from the problems in Sierra Leone or in Guinea, for that matter.
Mel Foote, your response.
Well, I think we should send troops. I think it shows American concern and American commitment. And I think, you know, we have to show that Americans are involved in everything, whether it's HIV/AIDS, whether it's conflict, resolving conflicts on the continent. Now, I think in terms of what those troops would do, I'm with Bill. I like to see, you know, the West Africans play a stronger force, because ultimately it's about regional integration and solving problems in Africa. But I like to see the U.S. Make a commitment. You know, we were involved in Bosnia at the same time they were cutting off arms in Sierra Leone, and we didn't intervene, but yet we intervened in Bosnia, you know. And so I think it's important psychologically to get America to understand that it has to have a similar policy for Europe as it has for Africa, a similar policy for Asia as it has for Africa, and stop playing Africa as a second fiddle.
Well, what about that? Showing U.S. concern for Africa by sending U.S. troops, Bill Fletcher.
It's interesting that Mel brings up Bosnia. Part of the problem, I mean, I agree with Mel at the philosophical level that there needs to be consistency. Absolutely. But you see, I think that the problem for me is not the presence of U.S. troops displaying U.S. support. When the Rwanda genocide went down, the United States was obstructive in terms of a U.N. approach to Rwanda. What I'm suggesting is, first of all, that the U.S. has no role as a unilateral force. Second, that there needs to be a role for organizations like the United Nations. And third, and most importantly, that Africans need to resolve the situation. That the African Union recently formed, part of its mission is to address hot spots just like Liberia. It seems to me that the role of the United States then is not to act in the name of the AU or instead of the AU, but to support the African Union with the financial and logistical assistance that it can give, but that Africans need to address the situation.
In 2000, when Bush was running for the presidency, he declared Africa, quote, doesn't fit into the national strategic interests of the United States. What is your response to that, Mel Foote? Condoleezza Rice saying something somewhat different in the last few days.
Yeah, I always felt it was taken out of context. It was said during the political election, and Bush, who no one gave a lot of credit for international affairs, the question was, where does Africa fit, you know, in terms of U.S. strategic interests? And he went down a checklist, Russia, China, you know, and so on and so on. Then he finally got to the Eskimos, then he got to Africa. So he was wrong, and he was out of step, but I think he was chastised probably unmercifully for that. What I would also suggest is that for the first time in history, African Americans, who are also very much a part of Africa, you know, we lose sight of the fact that the diaspora is also part of Africa. For the first time in history, African Americans are helping to shape U.S. policy toward Africa, from a Colin Powell to a Jedediah Frazier, Condoleezza Rice, to a Bill Fletcher, to a Mel Foote, and others. For the first time, we really do have a lot to say about the direction of U.S. policy toward Africa, whether it's a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. So I think, in a certain sense, Africa is solving Africa's problems for the first time.
What would the U.S. troops in Liberia do? And what about the history of the Firestone plant in Liberia and Liberians' feelings about that U.S. multinational that had been there for so many years, Bill Fletcher?
Interesting when you raise, I have to say one thing though, Amy. I think that when Bush said what he said about Africa, he meant it. That Africa was not on the screen, and that was basically their attitude until September 11th. And from that point on, from September 11th, Africa got on the screen, but it got on the screen mainly from the standpoint of securing oil reserves. And now they're talking about deploying U.S. troops there, and I and a lot of other people are getting nervous. In terms of the Liberian history, it's important to understand Liberia was settled as a colony for ex-slaves. But in settling Liberia, the settlement was done on top of the people that were already there. And a vassal state was created by the United States to serve its interests in Africa, and that this, in fact, laid the conditions for the civil wars that began roughly 20 years ago. The Liberian government was a loyal supporter of the United States during the Cold War, and made sure that U.S. economic interests, as you mentioned with Firestone, were protected. The situation obviously has become very chaotic over the last 20 years, and there's been no stability in terms of resolving the basic situation. So in one sense, the United States has a definite obligation to address the situation because, in fact, it helped to create it. I don't think, though, that that happens through U.S. troops, because one never knows what the outcome of a U.S. troop deployment will actually be.
We're talking to Bill Fletcher and Mel Foote about the possibility of the United States sending troops to join a U.N. peacekeeping force in Liberia. This, as President Bush leaves yesterday, his 57th birthday, with Laura Bush for a five-day African trip. They will begin in Senegal, and they will take a trip to Gori Island, the infamous former slave port. Your responses to that, to the president being on Gori Island?
Who do you want to go first?
Mel Foote.
Happy. You know, like America policy has never been what it need be, and we agree that it's a long way from where it got to go, and we're going to keep pushing to make that happen. But I think we're growing Africa in the minds of the United States. And, you know, just think 10 years ago, you know, our perception about what American president would say about Africa. I thought Bill Clinton did a lot in terms of raising the visibility and putting it up on the bully pulpit. He got it out there. And I think Bush did an excellent job of looking at it and saying, yeah, that makes political sense. And we're going to continue to build on AGOA. We're going to continue to expand on HIV/AIDS issues dramatically. We're going to get involved in solving conflicts in Sudan and Congo. And they're not there yet. On a scale of 1 to 10, I give them about maybe a 6 or a 7. But I think they're on the right track. I think they're on the right train. I think they're moving with gusto, and I'm excited about it. So I'm glad the president is going. I'm glad he's going to Gori Island. He will learn a lot more about us by going. Maybe symbolic, but I think I've been to the door of no return. Can't help but feel compelled to better understand, you know, the impact of Africans on America over the last 200 years.
Bill Fletcher, that and the stop he will make in South Africa not being a meeting with President Nelson Mandela?
You know, Mel is the eternal optimist, and I respect that, even though I respectfully disagree. I look at this trip as a photo op that I put on the same level as landing on the aircraft carrier. That basically this is preparation for November 2004, and it's attempting to remind or make African Americans, or at least a segment of us, believe that November 2000 in Florida really wasn't all that bad, and that there is a commitment by this alleged compassionate conservative to support our interests. I don't see it. I don't see in the way that this trip was planned. I don't see in the ways that the president ignored the fact that the African Union is meeting at this moment in Mozambique, and that there were no contingencies for the president to actually address the AU. There was no attempt. And then you add to that the Lilliputian approach towards South Africa and meeting with President Mandela. The fact that the president of the United States would not make a point of attempting to meet with President Mandela just displays the smallness in the way that they're looking and the vengeful thinking that they have when they're looking at differences. The fact that President Mandela had the guts, the gall to stand up to President Bush around Iraq, I think infuriates them.
Bill Fletcher is the president of TransAfrica, and Mel Foote is the president and CEO of Constituency for Africa, a coalition of organizations and groups that educate Americans about Africa and African issues. They spoke with Amy Goodman on this morning's Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.